You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 183 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
The Ricardo Lockett edition.
Yes it is. So last week was such a big week of sports.
Yes.
We talked about a lot of it on our emergency pod after the Monday Night Football game. Talked about the Seahawks win over the undefeated 49ers, as well as Sounders' MLS Cup triumph over Toronto FC. There was a lot more we didn't talk about, but the Seattle sports gods, they said, last week was a little bit too much excitement. You need to like take it down a notch. You need, the heart rates need to return to normal. And so that's why this week, for the first time since the NFL instituted byes in 1990, both the Seahawks and the Huskies have a bye in the same weekend.
Wow!
No.
Since 1990, ever, right?
And the first time ever, yeah, because before 1990, there were no byes.
How did that not just happen by chance at some point before this?
It's weird. The Huskies, for a long time, the byes did not really get added to the college football schedule until fairly recently. They're a fairly modern invention. And then, I mean, at that point, I guess there's like a 1 in 12 chance any year that you're going to give if there's one bye week out of 12. This year, there were two bye weeks, so it was more likely yes. that the Huskies would overlap.
Wow.
But just hasn't happened.
I mean, this is going to add days onto our lives.
It's not, I don't know, is it going to add or is it just going to keep it the same? And the other ones are subtracting them from our lives.
The Husky game was not too stressful on Friday night.
No, the basketball game was a little more stressful.
That was the one that was, and we will be having one of those this weekend.
Yes.
Miraculously, Husky basketball managed to schedule a big game that wasn't opposite an NFL game or another Husky football game.
That is accurate.
Somebody is getting fired in the UW athletic department for not scheduling this game against another big game.
I will say in fairness to them that I'm not sure they have a lot of control over it, and perhaps my employers have some control over it. Well, because these games are televised, is what I'm saying here.
I understand what you're saying.
I caught the full West Coast swing of the Jay Billis, Dan Shulman duo, because they did the Huskies game in Alaska on Friday night, and then on Tuesday they were at the Moda Center for the doubleheader there that I attended.
There you go. But we definitely needed a break.
We do.
After everything that happened last weekend,
another 2 hour pod.
A second to reset.
Yeah.
A little bit of a sports break.
I think it's well timed because then we're going to go into the stretch run, not for the Husky football, because their meaningful season is already over.
I mean, they've already got the big data bowl clinched. I'm not going to give that up. That joke is coming back to that joke. It's too good.
I don't know. Scholars are divided on that issue.
Anyway, we've got a lot of toasts to get to, though.
We got a few toasts
back
here
on that huge week in Seattle sports.
Yes, and we are going to toast using what has I don't think it's my number one anymore.
Oh, I just had a whole tie-in.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Well, I had a couple of tie-ins that I was angling for, but here's what I was going for. Because we were going to toast to what you said was your number one burger, and I figured
that is accurate.
We would toast with your number one beer.
But sadly, we won't, because we don't have Fremont Field to Ferment at this point has taken the crown. Although, you know what I had the other night that was quite good?
What's that?
Russian River Blind Pig.
Okay.
I was down in Portland, and so I was at
showing
Russian
off
River
that you have access to yeah. Russian River?
Yeah.
Great.
That was
well,
quite good.
Aren't you special with your distribution?
I chose that over Field to Ferment. They had that on tap as well.
But you could get Field to Ferment
exactly.
in Washington State.
Exactly.
Of course you chose it over Field to Ferment. Anyway, what is the beer that has been dethroned?
That is the Ballast Point Grapefruit Sculpin IPA. The best of the Sculpins.
All right.
So we start with a toast to Jadeveon Clowney, who was named the NFC Defensive Player of the Week after his dominant performance in aforementioned Seahawks Monday night victory in San Francisco, including scoring a defensive touchdown. You had nothing to say on that?
Wreaked havoc all over the field.
Yeah.
I mean, I already told you he was one of the best players to ever put on a Seahawks uniform.
You also said earlier offline that the Seahawks need to re-sign him at any cost. Something like that.
I think it is reasonable that the Seahawks could pay him the most of any team. Not asking for any sort of like hometown discount or whatever.
Yes.
And it would still be a good decision.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Because let me tell you the alternatives.
The winner's curse is not real. Oh, boy, yeah.
I think we should talk about that in the Seahawks.
Okay. Okay, that was a troubling thread the other day from Zach Whitman. Also, UW men's basketball, after that win over Baylor that we alluded to earlier, jumped into the AP rankings at number 20 for the first time this season. And lastly, we should in fact toast to, you mentioned it, my favorite burger in Seattle, back for 1 week and 1 week only. It is the mac and cheeseburger at Lil Woody's featuring Beecher's world famous mac and cheese.
How was the 2019 vintage of the mac and cheeseburger?
An excellent crop of mac and cheeseburger, if I do say so myself.
Which location did you go to?
Capitol Hill.
Oh, okay. Good call. you made the right call there.
Yeah, I met some friends there, so that was the spot to go to. And I enjoyed that after I posted that on Instagram, got a message from the listener, Lukey Crowley, asking, what is this? Mm. Suggesting that he was not paying attention last year when we talked about the mac and cheeseburger or the year before. I guess that's a little disconcerting. But you know what? Better late than never. Because his response after that was, after I explained it, was, I need to get there immediately. Just this week? Yes. Plays will have to be made.
Wow.
So,
I mean, there's no football games to be making
plays.
That's
true. That's a good point.
You're going to have to make the plays of your own.
I mean, it's a great burger. This is, to me, my favorite. I guess maybe there'll be one in between this year because the Thanksgiving leftovers burger will probably not be until presumably the week of Thanksgiving. So there is a week in between there.
With the late Thanksgiving this year.
Yes. It's throwing everything off this late Thanksgiving.
I like
including the double byes in the college football season.
That's why they're having the double byes, because the late
Thanksgiving. I mean, not actually because of Thanksgiving, but the schedule is a week longer than normal this year.
The NFL season goes way into January also, right?
But it's also like a super late Labor Day or super early. I don't know. I guess it was super early Labor Day. So I don't know. That doesn't make any sense now that I think about it. Pay no attention.
You're going to have to crunch the numbers
about that comment.
Yeah, let us know when you get back, when you figure out what day Labor Day is.
Well, because the Huskies college football season opened in August this year, did it not? I'm remembering that correctly, right?
It opens in August every year.
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
It opens Labor Day weekend, and most of the time
it was an early Labor Day and a late Thanksgiving, and it makes this year longer.
Yes.
Are there 53 weeks in this year?
No.
Wow.
No.
Okay.
It's just wherever they manage to be structured within the fall.
We'll save this for the Gregorian Pelton cast.
I prefer the Julian Pelton cast myself.
I was going to say the Roman Pelton cast, but there's a person named Roman Pelton.
Yes. Sorry. Well, there's a person. Yeah, no. There's a Julian Pelton as well, isn't there?
In our family?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, they may be siblings.
Yeah. Well, they have there are themes in the family. You've got biblical authors in Italian.
Uh-huh.
And they've got calendars.
Oh.
Yeah. So anyways, the mac and cheeseburger, available through next Monday. Assuming you're using the same calendar as we are.
Calendars. You're using one of those Pelton calendars.
You should definitely check that one out. We did have to talk about something else I ate this week.
What was that?
As you may have seen on Instagram, I went to the other Taco Time.
Oh, hello.
So I was going out to see the movie Parasite, which I highly recommend. It was a very entertaining movie. It's recommended on Twitter by third Pelton brother Mina Kimes.
Okay.
That's what... I don't know if that was the first place I heard about it, but
I'm saving the first movie I see in 2019 for Uncut Gems.
Okay. Which there was a trailer for that before Parasite, and I don't think I ever watched the trailer when it came out, and everyone was so excited back in September. I just paid attention to everyone else's reaction to the trailer, and I get it.
Okay.
I get why everyone was so excited. So anyway, this was, I had to drive out deep into the Portland suburbs to find a place that was playing that. It was not at the location near the Moda Center that I usually go to movies there when I'm killing an afternoon in Portland. And it's right by the, it was right by the food court there. And I kind of wanted something to tide me over in case I got hungry during this movie. And lo and behold, there in the food court staring at me was The Other Taco Time.
Okay. So. How was it? You say this like it's an exciting thing, but I feel like our general tone is anti The Other Taco Time.
We have different takes on this.
Really?
I find The Other Taco Time, like, it's obviously inferior, but they're not actually in competition with each other in any way.
It's not about them being in competition with each other. It's just if you know that there could be a Taco Time that's really good with really fresh ingredients, and then you also have one that's not as good with not as fresh ingredients, why would you ever go to that one? You know what a perfect Taco Time looks like.
But my options there were not going to Taco Time Northwest or going to Taco Time International. It was going to Taco Time International or going to Sbarro. Okay, that's the level of choices we're talking here in the mall food court at the Clackamas Town Center.
I've spent a couple weekends at the Clackamas Town Center before. So it was Sbarro versus Taco Time International. Those were your only options?
Those were not the only two options. I'm just saying, that's a level we're talking about here. There was a Cinnabon. So I got some stuffed Mexi fries.
Stuffed Mexi fries?
Yes.
Did they have that when I went?
Yes. Okay. I had it when we went to the one in Walla Walla.
What are they stuffed with?
Or in Yakima, I should say. So they're stuffed with like tiny little peppers and some like corn, I think.
That sounds horrible.
They're fine.
Okay.
I don't think they're preferable to Mexi fries. That was really the entirety of the story. I just needed to address why I went there and posted about it on Instagram, because definitely there were a lot of negative reactions to that in the direct messages we got on IG.
Regale us with more of your great stories.
I feel like anytime you go to The Other Taco Time, that needs to be mentioned.
I guess so. I was more excited about hearing about the Clackamas Town Center.
You want any other thoughts on the Clackamas Town Center?
I'm good. You better timestamp that one. Kevin tells a bad story.
Oh, no. Well, the reason you say that, lastly, we do have a listener note. The listener Fuzzy Dunlop 1000 left a review on iTunes, a positive review, but saying, wish they timestamped their segments. And I want to make sure everyone knows this in case you're just listening to the podcast and not getting to it from Twitter, where I post the link to it. If you go to soniccentral.com/peltoncast, the homepage for the Peltoncast, and go to the post note associated with each episode of the podcast, the day after, I don't have the chance to do it because of the fact that we post this at night after we record it, but the following morning, I will go in and timestamp each episode with where we talk about, you know, the various different sports teams and the food portions of the podcast during that part of the year. So if you're only interested in a specific, in this case, probably Seahawks content, you can find out exactly where to skip to get that content.
And can you tell them exactly where to skip to so that they don't have to hear that story about Taco Time International?
No.
The precise location to skip to not hear your stuffed Mexi fry story. You don't even have confidence about what they would have stuffed with.
I know, that's true.
You didn't really prepare for the story very well.
Well,
my God.
Since that went so well, let's instead talk some sports and begin with our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by our friends at Poliachi Pizza.
Because Poliachi wants basketball back in Seattle, and so do we.
You know who maybe doesn't want basketball in Seattle?
Who's
or
that?
Didn't want basketball in Seattle? That's Ed Evans.
Really?
So
you're going to have to explain who Ed Evans is.
I am. So as we've discussed previously on the podcast, the Ringer, through their partnership with Luminary podcast app, has been...
I feel like you started sweating because I was grilling you about this stuff. 100%
did, yeah.
It's like we're under the hot... It's like, man, you're being interviewed for a crime here. And I'm like, what was in the stuffed Mexi fries?
So also while I was down in Portland, went to my number one ramen spot, a Fury Ramen.
Okay.
And was sweating so profusely while eating the ramen there with... my ESPN colleague Mike Schmitz.
Wow. And, name dropping again.
A friend of ours in the scouting community. So Yeah, it was like very embarrassing because I was sweating so profusely while eating this ramen, and it wasn't that hot. It was not necessary for me to sweat that much. Anyways, The Ringer, Luminary, the Sonic Boom podcast hosted by Jordan Ritter-Kahn. And they've also, if you don't subscribe or take advantage of the free trial for Luminary, Jordan has been posting articles that kind of summarize each episode of the podcast. Last week, they finally got to what I had talked about being really excited about at the start of this series, which is they went and interviewed Ed Evans, who was the person who initially made contact with the Sonics ownership group about buying the team. He was based in Oklahoma City, but was not born and raised there and a fixture in the Oklahoma City community in the same way that the group that ended up buying the team was. And he came out as part of the original announcement of the sale, was on the dais for the press conference, came and addressed the employees the next day. We were under the impression that he was going to become the president of the team and, you know, really the point person for this new ownership group in Seattle. And then fast forward 3 months, the sale of the team is approved by the NBA Board of Governors. They put out a press release about this. There's a list of names in the ownership group, and Ed Evans has completely disappeared, and nobody heard from him for 13 years.
It's funny because he described himself in the most recent episode, not the Ed Evans episode, as being the person who Seattle hates. And it was like, Seattle doesn't know who you are, dude.
Absolutely.
Like, if you want to be hated, I suppose you can be.
Oh, he managed to accomplish that, I think.
But it's not enough people. Seattle is not listening to this podcast. You know, not that many people in Seattle are listening to it. And at the end of this podcast, nobody is going to look back on it and be like, fuck Ed Evans. I can tell you there's one name who people are probably still not happy with about it. And that person is not Ed Evans. And it's like, dude, just you're going to have to do more to get Seattle to hate you.
Well, my friend Matt, who I had lunch with, my former coworker at the Sonics, let me tell you, he hates Ed Evans at this point.
There we go.
Ed was tweeting at him on Twitter. So the amazing thing that we discovered...
That's what Ed Evans was really looking for. He wanted the hate tweets.
So Jordan explains that like they tried to track him down after learning about Ed Evans' existence from Wally Walker when they were interviewing him. And... you know, couldn't find anything, but then just discovered this guy, matching his name on Twitter, complaining about fast food. And they sent him a DM, and he got back to him.
He was complaining about fast food?
Yeah.
I thought he was complaining about, like...
They're both.
Airport status of, like, airport lounges or whatever. Yeah,
there was something that was, like, a high-end thing, but then he was also replying to, like, Wendy's and Burger King. And I think he may have had an anti-chicken nuggets take at Wendy's. And
wow.
Having had the Wendy's
like,
chicken nuggets.
Keep your spicy chicken nuggets, Wendy's. I'm fine, thank you.
Having had the Wendy's chicken nuggets last night, agree to disagree, good sir.
He's like, I'm from Oklahoma. We don't need your spicy chicken nuggets.
His Burger King take may have been accurate. So they just...
That's what we're really here to roast Ed Evans about, is his fast food takes.
They just shoot him a DM, and he replies and is like, sure, I'd love to talk. And they go out to his house and interview him, which is amazing, too, because, I mean, you know, when you said that most people in Seattle don't know Ed Evans, that's obviously accurate. But those of us who were, like, on the inside and heard him talk to us employees the next day have spent the last 13 years wondering what the hell happened. He's been, like, the great mystery of this. And... the interview with him sort of solved it, but then raised all sorts of new mysteries. He explained that, you know, initially he had a group put together to make a bid for the Sonics, and it was composed entirely of investors who were not from Oklahoma City besides him. He said primarily based in New York and Chicago, which tracks with what Wally and, you know, people on the other side have said about, you know, the sale process, and that... at some point in the process, he came to the conclusion, like, if they moved to Oklahoma City, it would be a bad idea not to have the titans of the Oklahoma City business community who ended up being part of the ownership group, part of it. And that's why he replaced all of the people who were not from Oklahoma City with those people from Oklahoma City who he had been meeting with from time to time because they were... all of them were attempting to buy the Hornets at that point when they were playing in Oklahoma City from George Shinn, who owned them at the time. So that was a little confusing, and his story changed over the course of the interview about whether he, you know, the plan A was to keep the team in Seattle or plan A was to move it to Oklahoma City. So, kind of a perplexing interview all told. I know more about it, but also have other questions.
I mean, he's still a little bit like the mark here, right? You know,
probably.
He's not the hero of the story because by involving those titans of the Oklahoma City business community, which...
And the reason he didn't become president...
He was forced out by those very same
right,
people.
Right, is that Clay Bennett told him on the flight to Seattle for this press conference, yeah, we've decided we don't want you as president.
But the reality is he was there as... He was the con man. He was the initial con man of this whole thing, right? And the real mark, if there is a mark in this process, is still Howard Schultz. Like... by the time that Clay yes. Bennett appeared in the conversation and they realized that this person from Oklahoma City, they knew Oklahoma was desperate for a basketball team, yes. right? I mean, you'd be stupid not to know that. And by the time that Clay Bennett, who was involved with the previous group that brought the Hornets to Oklahoma City, became part of this group, that's when Howard Schultz should have ended the conversation.
Agreed.
If he actually cared about keeping the team in Seattle, the conversation would have been dead.
I object to the use of the term actually cared because I do think he believed in that good faith clause, but that was excessively naive. I think it's fair to say.
Good faith literally means nothing. Like if you
it actually is a specific legal term. It does mean
but
something.
There's no time period. If you cared that much about keeping the team in Seattle, you would put in a clause that they had to keep the team in Seattle for X amount of years.
Well, I mean, that probably would not have made sense beyond the lease. I mean, like, obviously they wouldn't have agreed to it at that point.
Or through the whole lease, right? Like, I'm sorry, but 1 year is not enough time to ensure that you could. But yeah. But that's what I'm saying. Like the real mark here is still, the person who got swindled was Howard Schultz.
Yeah.
And probably everybody else on the group of nine or whatever.
Well, not everyone else, because as Wally Walker pointed out, it was a 5-4 vote with
him
voting against.
The four other people alongside Howard Schultz who voted to sell the team to these people from Oklahoma City who clearly would move it.
Yep.
You know, and it's just like, they were still like, I don't blame Ed Evans necessarily for what he did. Like it's a classic con, right? You go in saying you're going to do one thing with an intention to do something else. And that's what you do. Right. But you need a mark to be able to pull off the con. And so it's like, do you blame the con man or do you blame the mark? Right.
I believe there's an expression, fool me once. I guess they only got fooled once. They only got fooled real bad. That was once was more than enough, as it turns out.
So I don't know. I just didn't hear that. The whole thing, I was just like, Howard was hell bent on selling this team, and I think he realized that the look of selling it to somebody who came out initially and said we are going to move this team, which would have been with Oracle or whatever, right?
Larry Ellison, yeah. I believe that he actually believed in the value of having the hammer of moving the team, I do believe he believed that would help politically.
Okay, so best case scenario, he was just completely misread the situation.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way to look at it.
Well, like, the team moved. Like, you know, no matter how good the process was, the results are what they are.
But there's just no way to look at it and be like, what Howard did here was right. You know, from any view. And so my question for you, I guess, after this, and so I just heard that podcast and the whole time with Ed Evans, I'm like, it's a little frustrating because, you know, he definitely came in and duped the ownership group.
And all the different places where, like, this could have gone awry. Like, if one of the things they mentioned is that his initial bid was, I believe it was $30 million short, and Goldman Sachs, who
Goldman
was facilitating
Sachs also,
the sale,
that's
got some questions for Goldman Sachs, as it turns out.
A villain that arose, but... I don't think that Goldman Sachs just determined this. I think there might have been conversations that the majority owner of the Sonics at the time
was having with them.
That Wally Walker might not have been aware of.
About the ability to move the team? I don't buy that.
Or the interest in wanting to get the team sold. I think Howard wanted to get the team sold desperately.
Sure.
And was willing to basically do whatever it took to get the team sold, including letting them move.
I don't agree with that.
If he went to Goldman Sachs, who was facilitating this process, and was like, the team cannot move from Seattle, they would not have described them as portable or whatever.
Sometimes people make decisions on their own. I mean, I don't know anything specific about this.
Goldman Sachs made this decision on their own.
I mean, Goldman Sachs, the way they make money is by selling the team. Well, yes. That's how they make the money. And that's kind of their motivation in the process.
They waited about 5 years. They would have made a whole lot more money. But it just, there was a second where it was like, the minute that Clay Bennett arrived in the conversation, it became the same as the Larry Ellison conversation. And like, what's the difference? Was that year and a half, or I guess two full basketball seasons of having people from Oklahoma own the team and the sort of like faux process of trying to get an arena done? Like, was that worth it, you know?
Ultimately, obviously not in hindsight.
It didn't matter at all. So it's just like the second that Clay Bennett arrived,
I think one of their big miscalculations is not realizing how angry David Stern was in the entire process. We haven't heard about David Stern.
Didn't need to matter, though. David Stern could be angry, but like if they wanted to keep the team in Seattle, if they wanted to sell it to a Seattle owner, David Stern can't force a team to move.
True, but at the same time, he can unilaterally block a move, which we learned with Sacramento a few years later, as it turned out. Not unanimously, but he does have enough to single-handedly block a move. So if he had not been so pro the Sonics moving, then the outcome would have been very different as well.
Okay. So they asked the villain question, right?
Yeah.
In this next episode,
which I'm surprised they got to that in questions in episode 7 and not in the final episode. But
how would you, as somebody who was involved in the process, let's go 1, 2, 3, 4, because there's no way that you can assign blame to one person.
No, that is the one thing that is abundantly clear if you listen to the podcast. I mean, I almost think it's more groups necessarily than it is individuals.
Okay.
I mean, I agree with him politically, so I hesitate to term Frank Chopp a villain necessarily, but I also don't think he was particularly interested in finding out the will of the people. And I think that the state house does not get nearly enough blame in this. Also, just the political process by which the state has to weigh in on a tax that has nothing to do with the rest of the state. That one still mystifies me all these years later. Because it's not like people in Eastern Washington were going to have to pay any tax to build the Sonics Arena. So why do they have a say in it?
The vote that happened about, like...
Well, there was no vote that ever happened. Because, Frank Chopp never let anything come to the
But the body. Vote about the X amount of money that can be spent...
That's I-91.
Yeah.
Yes.
Was that the city or was that a state?
That was the city of Seattle.
So didn't the people have their will then? Like, you're talking about the will of the people.
But they weren't voting. I mean, by proxy to some extent, they were voting on, you know, how okay are you with the Sonics moving. But, I think it's easy to overplay I-91. Like, I-91 still exists. We're building arenas in the city of Seattle, as it turns out. Now, they ended up exempting the Key Arena rebuild from I-91. But the belief was that it would meet the standard. The argument was that it would meet the standard established by I-91. And that they just did it to basically save time. But that also...
So you've started at Frank Chopp / legislature as your number one.
I mean, the Mariners... Can I call the Mariners and Seahawks villains in this? Like, honestly, the fact
the
that they got
that
arenas...
You're going is so strange. Like,
but that's the thing, is there's tentacles that are like 3 decades deep in this story. Like, quite frankly, the Ackerley family is a villain in this for... Like, not following through the plan to build an arena where Safeco Field stand or T-Mobile stands today. Like, if they had just built the arena there in 1987 or 1990 or whatever year that was, wouldn't have any of these problems in 2008. But instead, Key Arena got rebuilt on the cheap, and that screwed up everything. I mean, again, there's like 1,000 different people that are involved here. That's why I kind of reject the premise of your question.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Like, this thing is so complex that you can do an 8-part podcast that's 4 hours long and still not cover even close to everything that happened.
Where do Clay and Ed Evans and the Oklahoma City ownership group, where do they rank? Like, are we at the point where ideally we'd like to have a team back in Seattle and would probably be willing to get a team back in Seattle at any means, therefore... We have to say that we don't care about those people?
I would reject the phrase any means. I mean, I think that what a thing that differentiated when Chris Hansen's group attempted to buy the Kings and move them here is there was never any subterfuge there. There was never any false designs that the team was going to stay in Sacramento with those with ownership that was invested in Seattle. It was, we're buying this team to move it. So that's a difference. And as you mentioned earlier, Larry Ellison wasn't willing to go through the subterfuge. He was just like, no, I want a team in San Jose. If I buy this team, I'm moving it to San Jose. So that clearly is an unethical aspect of what the Oklahoma City ownership group did.
But now there's a team in Oklahoma City and there's not a team in San Jose.
The ends probably justify the means in their minds, I think fairly so.
But also the reason...
But they're low, because the other thing that didn't necessarily come up in that discussion is, look, if it wasn't Oklahoma City, it was going to be somewhere else. The Sonics were never going to stay in Seattle without a renovation to Key Arena or a new arena. And everything else is just details.
You don't think if the team gets sold to somebody like Steve Ballmer or a wealthy person from Seattle that that changes things?
It gives you more time to figure out that process.
Steve Ballmer is not moving this team from Seattle. And he's probably not selling the team either.
Presumably not.
I mean, he currently is in a fight over an arena right now and seems pretty committed to keeping that team there.
But he also is able to devote all his time to that team because he's no longer running Microsoft.
Yeah, no,
which was kind of time-consuming. And that's the thing. It's like Steve Ballmer is not a villain in this by any sense of the imagination, but it's just all these
Steve
little...
Steve Ballmer's definitely not.
He's unquestionably not a villain, but like there's all these little things that if Ballmer had retired 10 years earlier, he owns the Sonics in Seattle, probably.
Does he have the same kind of money?
I mean, maybe marginally different. No one had as much money back then, as it turns out.
The whole thing is just frustrating, though. The whole podcast. It's
I mean, the...
It's like a... It's kind of a fun listen, but also... I mean, the whole time I'm just like, who is this for? I think I mentioned this to you. I'm like, are there casual fans that are not affiliated with either of the teams that are listening to this? Because it feels very esoteric for Sonics fans in particular.
Yeah, that's probably the case.
Okay, what do you make of, this is sort of on the same subject, of the sort of news story from the Washington Post today that Jeff Bezos was potentially interested in buying the Seahawks?
I mean, that wasn't even the story necessarily, was it? It was that the NFL would welcome him. I guess it was that he had interest, but that the NFL would welcome him as an owner. Which,
you think,
like,
the Washington Post has access to Jeff Bezos? To get the quote?
He declined comment.
God.
I mean, I don't think that Jeff Bezos is like hanging out at the Washington Post offices all the time, particularly not at the sports desk.
You
like,
think he could have killed it if he wanted to?
He probably could have killed it if he wanted to. It's probably a fine story.
He's like, oh, I decline.
Mean, the Seahawks aren't currently for sale.
Yes.
When they become for sale, this will be a story. Until then, I didn't even put it in the notes because I didn't feel like it needed to be talked about at this point.
Do you think it means anything with regards to basketball? We sort of talked about this last week. If Jeff Bezos wants a basketball team in Seattle, can he make it happen with the kind of money that he has?
Not right now, no. There's none available.
You don't think he could convince the league to expand by the possibility of having Jeff Bezos as his owner?
Nope.
I
mean, the NBA's position is, look, every time that you expand, it's basically the same as giving up selling equity. Because right now you have this TV money that is the primary source of revenue in the NBA. And right now it's being split up 30 ways. And if you expand, it's going to be split up 32 ways. And there's going to be less of it for you.
Couldn't it be split up 31 ways?
Sure. I mean, more likely they would expand by two for scheduling purposes.
Couldn't an owner pay enough in expansion fees that they were able to make up 10 years of TV money, 20 years of TV money, whatever?
Oh, I mean, the fee that Chris Hansen was willing to pay for the Kings and relocation would have done it for several decades.
So then what's the issue there?
Because the NBA views it as an infinite revenue stream, basically.
Wow. I've given this advice to a lot of people. The NBA.
Be cool.
Watch out. This is not a be cool. This is a watch out. Because TV money is not going to exist forever in the same way.
I think viewership money is going to exist forever. I don't know if it'll be at the same level, but...
They are probably making the most in sort of viewership money right now than they will ever make. Also, they seem to have kind of angered a pretty big TV market overseas.
You're definitely not talking about that.
Anyway, I think it's a ridiculous standpoint that, like, I understand the idea. And this is, David Stern is coming from, they want to hold cities hostage for arenas, right?
I don't know if I necessarily like the use of the term hostage.
But, like, the Sonics...
They want to show cities that there are consequences to be paid if you do not support basketball in your city.
That those consequences will be taking a team from a top 20 TV market to a number 60 TV market. It's just, like, they still... I know that it doesn't really matter.
But the way that the David Stern would look at it is... We got a new arena in Sacramento. We got a new arena in Milwaukee.
Thank God, they kept the team in Sacramento.
We got renovations in Minnesota. We got public money in Indianapolis. And all of this stemmed from Seattle.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, he threw Seattle under the bus for all of these other things.
Because if it can happen in Seattle, it can happen anywhere.
Okay.
Should we talk about the Blazers?
Oh, God.
Hey, they signed Carmelo Anthony.
Oh, no.
Exciting news. Several time All-Star. I don't know how many times Melo has been an All-Star, but several time All-Star Carmelo Anthony is going to Portland.
There we go.
Two short years after, or I guess, is it three? No, it's two. Two short years after Dame and CJ spent the entire summer, like, basically on Twitter trying to lobby him to waive his no-trade clause and come to Portland. And back then, they were going to be giving up, like, Mo Harkless to get him and some other stuff. Now, they're just signing him for a non-guaranteed contract for the veterans minimum.
Yeah, if you wait long enough, you can sign anybody for a non-guaranteed contract.
Michael Jordan still out there for a non-guaranteed contract.
Any player that you'd like to sign for a non-guaranteed contract, wait 6 or 7 years.
So particularly this new need got exacerbated when Zach Collins had to undergo shoulder surgery. He's expected to be out until at least March at this point. And so without him at power forward, the Blazers have tried starting Anthony Tolliver, who looks pretty finished as an NBA contributor at this point. As John Hollinger keeps pointing out, was out of the rotation much of the last year for a lottery team. Mario Hezonja, who is
a power forward.
Yeah. Where he got just destroyed by Pascal Siakam in the post last night. It was bad. And then eventually they tried Nasir Little, who never started a game in North Carolina, but now has started a game in the NBA.
No.
And he was pretty good defensively, gave them some energy, but he also shot like 3 of 10 from the field and 1 of 5 from 3. So not maybe a long-term solution.
I was looking at the aforementioned John Hollinger's PER today, and I think Nasir Little had a 5 PER.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Is Carmelo going to work? Probably not. Is what the Blazers are running out right now going to work? Nope. So,
I mean, he's
probably not better than nope.
More of a professional basketball player at this point than Nasir Little.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. What the hell?
That was Jason Quick's take. What the hell?
I mean, they're 4-8. They have no depth whatsoever. They have Dame, who... I didn't realize this, so far is playing like his best season ever.
Yeah. I mean, he was the most valuable player before last night when he shot 2 of 12.
It feels like, I don't know, maybe Dame's not getting caught up in it, but just people look at their record and they look at the best player and that's how you judge team, right? But Dame is playing kind of out of his mind.
I mean, he scored 60 points and they lost.
He probably needs to go on like a Harden-like run where he's just scoring 60, where I start betting you that he's going to score 80.
I mean, I'm happy to take that bet at any time, that action at any time, if you want to go for it.
Dame might need to start going on a run like that. But so he's playing his best season ever.
Yeah.
And it's just like if they had any depth around him, things would be different.
And if CJ McCollum were playing better, that's one thing that I think will inevitably...
Is there a reason that CJ isn't playing well?
That's probably just 12 games.
He'll just regress.
Yeah.
So it's not necessary. I guess it is panic button time for the Blazers because they signed Carmelo Anthony.
Yeah.
So
we'll there you happens. Go. All right, the Sounders, you'll recall, won the MLS Cup on Tuesday. They held a parade that, much as in 2016 when they won, culminated at Seattle Center. Sadly, was not able to be there because I was headed down to Portland for that James Wiseman game, Memphis against Oregon on Tuesday night, but it looked like, I think, a slightly bigger crowd than they had in 2016. Certainly, as we talked about in the podcast, the recap that Third Pelton brother Chris Smith and I did, it felt like this moment captured the city of Seattle more so than 2016. But this being MLS, you got to move on quickly. And the expansion draft is set for next Tuesday as newcomers Inter Miami and Nashville SC can draft up to 5 players apiece among the 19 eligible teams who did not have players selected in last year's expansion draft by FC Cincinnati. Those protected lists will be announced on Saturday. The Sounders can protect up to 12 players with young homegrown products automatically ineligible. So they don't need to protect, for example, Danny Leiva does not need to be protected, certainly. And I think Jordan Morris also is ineligible. So, you know, you'll be able to protect the core of the team, won't lose any core players in this upcoming expansion draft. Also, has not been a lot of reporting yet on how the roster is going to take shape for 2020, but Gustav Svensson told the Swedish media that he will return for 2020, and Roman Torres, who joined the Panamanian national team, said it's up to the Sounders who have his option for next year. There's also been longtime rumors connecting the other starting center back in the MLS Cup final, Kim Keehee, with a move to the Middle East. So that's a position to watch. Javier Arriaga probably steps into a larger role next year, assuming that he can stop getting red carded every time he starts. But definitely want some depth there, particularly with the Sounders playing in CONCACAF Champions League next year. So they'll have a more crowded fixture schedule. So we'll know more next week about how the Sounders 2020 roster is shaping up. UW men's basketball, as we mentioned at the top, got a 67-64 win in the Armed Forces Classic on Friday against number 16 Baylor in Anchorage, coming from behind in that game after trailing pretty much throughout the first 35 minutes or so of it. Then on Tuesday night in their home opener, beat Mount St. Mary's 56-46, another game where they came from behind, less impressively so, in that one against what should have been an overmatched opponent. Any thoughts on the Husky men's basketball team through the first two games?
It was so much fun to watch this team.
It was.
Did I already joke last week that Husky football is going to go to the Armed Forces Classic?
You didn't, I don't think.
Okay.
Because I don't think you knew that.
With that win on Friday, they became eligible for the Armed Forces Classic, though.
You didn't know what the Armed Forces Classic was until that game started, and you were trying to understand where they were playing the game, if I recall correctly. Are they playing it huge on the Air Force Base
to
get to the Armed Forces? They still got to get the invite.
Yeah, you don't automatically go. I think in the spring or so, when the roster was starting to look set, I basically outlined the apocalypse scenario of this Husky basketball team, and I would say, which is young team, no shooting. Pretty unproven in a lot of ways, right?
Yep.
And I want to both take a victory lap and then also eat crow here at the same time.
Oh, because intriguing.
I think that I was correct in my assessment of the team, right?
I mean, it's definitely a young roster.
And they can't shoot.
I don't know if I'd go so far as to say they can't shoot. They are shooting 36% on threes thus far, but it's not a strength of the team.
They don't have any sort of like pure natural shooters on the team, right?
They do. It's just Raekwon Battle is that player, and he has yet to see action through two games.
In the rotation, how about that?
Yes.
The thing that I did not estimate, though, is just how good this team is going to be on defense.
I think this is something I brought up is... Like, obviously, you're losing Matisse Thybulle.
It up after seeing Jaden play.
No, I mentioned this in the spring.
Okay.
That they were going to have... That if you looked at the roster the last couple of years, it did not make sense as a zone roster other than Matisse Thybulle. And Matisse Thybulle was sort of single-handedly dragging it to zone competence and maybe even excellence. But this year's roster, now all of a sudden, you've got a lot of length in the front court. You're starting a front court that goes, you know, Isaiah Stewart is 6'9". Jaden is, I don't know, he's also 6'9", but has arms that go forever. And then Hamir Wright established himself as the other starter there, also 6'9". So all of a sudden, you've got a lot of length along that front line. And then it was interesting. I mean, obviously, Quade Green is very important for his leadership and ball handling. But the Huskies made that run against Baylor when he was on the bench and they were playing the on-the-run backcourt of Bay and Carter. So now you're going 6'6", 6'5", in the backcourt. That's a giant effing team right there. That's a zone-looking team.
The Isaiah Stewart in the middle is just, it's a different presence than Noah Dickerson. Right? Yeah. He can't finish like Noah Dickerson. Noah's not a zone player. But like,
or at least a center.
I mean, Isaiah Stewart is a monster in the paint, in the zone. And him and Jaden, like, if you're going to throw that ball in the paint, you're going up against something pretty scary with the both of them.
I think they had 11 blocks in that game. In the opener, I don't know how that changed, because originally Jaden McDaniels got credited with 0 blocks, and then eventually got credited with 4, which I thought he had like 2 or 3. So somehow I was wrong both times.
Well, and early in the game, it was kind of like, how is Baylor scoring? Or it felt like the type of game where it was like, oh, they're just gonna hit everything.
Yeah, they were
like,
gonna hit threes.
These big men are gonna hit these like 6-foot jump shots that I just know that they can't hit. You know, especially going up against this defense. And they went cold at the very end because of that defense.
I mean, they ended up shooting 34% on twos in that game, which, again, 11 of them got, did I have that correct? Oh, 10 of them got blocked out of 44. So,
I mean, they had to have missed a lot of shots in the last 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, I think they, I mean, they win an extended period without scoring.
So, I don't think that I accurately understood just how good this defense is. And
the defense was still pretty good against Mount St. Mary's.
Oh, I mean, they gave up 46 points.
The offense, well, the defense was still pretty good. Mount St. Mary's shot 27% on twos in that game. Couldn't even get to the Baylor level. Unfortunately, the Huskies had 15 turnovers and shot 5 of 18 on threes in that game.
And then also seeing Jaden play is just like it, kind of insane. Like, we heard your description of him as being Andre Kirilenko like, but I think without actually seeing it, it's hard to really.
You never saw Andre Kirilenko.
What?
You never saw Andre Kirilenko. I mean, that's the point of a comparison, is you understand what someone plays like even when you haven't seen them.
But it's just, it's different. When you can't imagine that he's that fluid, you know, like we've seen some very good freshmen come in, and Jalen Noel is really fluid as a freshman. But aside from that, like, we saw top ranked players who didn't just move so seamlessly with the ball like Jaden does and move around the court. Like, I mean, we're talking significantly more of a basketball player than like Tony Roten, Markelle Fultz, players like that.
I don't know if I'd necessarily say that, but he is a more fluid athlete than those guys. I would agree with that. I thought it was encouraging against Mount St. Mary's that even though he shot so poorly, 2 of 9 from the field, that he still filled out the box score, had 9 rebounds, 4 assists, 2 steals, 2 blocks, and that one also 5 turnovers.
When you can see there's going to be a lot of growth, but watching Jaden play, it's like...
It's also interesting that Hop just didn't take him off the court in that game. He played 39 minutes. The rotation basically went just 6 players. Jamal played 17 minutes. Elijah Hardy played 9. And then the rest of the rotation, which was Sam Timmons and Nate Roberts, played a combined 6 minutes against Mount St. Mary's. So it is pretty thin right now. You'd like to see that grow, and hopefully they will have the opportunity to do that later next week against Maine. But first up, another competition that perhaps UW football could have postseason play in, the Naismith Hall of Fame Classic against Tennessee in Toronto this Saturday at 2 p.m., a game that will be streaming on ESPN+.
This is not on TV.
It is not on over-the-air TV, no.
It seems really strange to me that UW Tennessee would not be.
Well, it's a Saturday during college football season. So... The time slots are limited in that window. The Volunteers, effectively number 30 in the AP rankings, 5th among teams receiving votes. They are much higher than that, number 21 overall in KenPom after a 2-0 start. They lost 3 players, Grant Williams, Admiral Schofield, and Jordan Bone, to the NBA from the team that reached number 1 last season and advanced to the Sweet 16. Didn't necessarily, unlike the Huskies, who brought in this like huge recruiting class to replace all the seniors they lost, not really the case at Tennessee. A lot of just players stepping into larger roles. They did add a top 20 recruit in Josiah Jordan James, who's an NBA prospect.
Triple J.
Yeah. But he's not necessarily been the biggest factor so far. Senior Lamonte Turner has taken over the point guard duties from Jordan Bone, has more than doubled his assist rate. And then senior wing Jordan Bowden is their leading scorer, has gone 6 of 9 in threes in their first two games. Tennessee doesn't really shoot a lot of threes.
Are you going to delete
that? No, I'm going to leave that in at this point.
The burp.
Yeah. Tennessee doesn't really shoot a lot of threes, but is shooting 46% on them so far this season. Also particularly tough on the offensive glass. I think one thing I look at their roster and think is they might struggle with Isaiah Stewart because their biggest rotation player is listed at 224 pounds, and Isaiah Stewart is a lot bigger and stronger than 224 pounds.
Whew. What do we view this as matchup-wise?
It's weird because the Huskies are technically the higher-ranked team, but I think Tennessee is a pretty clear favorite.
They're the better team.
Yeah. I don't know if the gamblers agree with that one. I didn't check out the spread if that exists on this yet. But, you know, Tennessee's a more experienced team, certainly. A lot of experience in big games for these seniors who have been a part of this team for several years here. So I think that's definitely the ESPN Basketball Power Index gives them a 74% chance of victory. That feels a little high to me.
74%?
Yeah. I don't see a line for this one, though. So maybe we're too far out still.
2 days?
I don't know. KenPom gives the Huskies a 40% chance, which is about how I feel in this one. I mean, one thing I think stands out is, like, there was pressure on the Huskies to win one of these big non-conference games. They've got Baylor and Tennessee and then hosting Gonzaga. And, like, if you looked at the KenPom projections, like, the odds are they were going to win one of those games. But maybe you win none and maybe you win two or three. And that kind of swings your season because those wins are so prominent nationally. Yes. Now, having already beaten Baylor, that's great news because there's no longer pressure on them to need to win this game. But if you can, it's all that much better for your eventual NCAA tournament hopes.
All right. I mean, if they win this game, I think we would start feeling like they were near the class of the Pac-12.
Yeah, I mean, Oregon was very impressive against Memphis at the Moda Center, but they'd be right there in the mix for sure.
It's just nice having any Pac-12 teams play well.
It sure is. So far, haven't been too many embarrassing losses for the Pac-12.
It's early.
Maine coming up on Tuesday and the second home game for the Huskies, the weakest opponent on UW's schedule this season. They did beat Merrimack by 20
in
their opener.
Merrimack, take that!
I mean, Merrimack higher rated on KenPom.
Are they
but,
really?
Yeah.
What state is Merrimack in?
Oh boy, they're new to Division I. I don't know this. I bet Baby Fantasy Genius doesn't even know what
I've
Merrimack's nickname is.
I've literally never heard the name Merrimack College.
Let me see if I can find.
I've scrolled through a lot of U.S. News and World Report top colleges, and Merrimack does not appear.
All right, they are the Warriors, and they are located in North Andover, Massachusetts.
Okay.
So there you go. All right. I believe they are new to Division I this year. Yes, this is their first year in playing Division I. Anyway, then
Maine was just like, welcome to Division I, Merrimack.
Maine then lost by 21 on Sunday at Harvard, coming off a 5-27 season where they had just one non-conference win over a Division I opponent.
Well, that's... So,
the other bit of news on Husky men's basketball, got a commitment on last weekend from 2021 four-star forward Jackson Grant from Olympia. He's the first player in that 2021 class, expected to be a big year for the Huskies. Not really a surprise here, as Grant grew up a Husky fan. Basically, as long as they showed interest, it seemed like a sure thing he was going to end up at UW.
All right.
And would that became the same, true also of Paolo Banchero.
I think he might have more interest than Jackson Grant.
Probably a little bit, yeah.
Although Kentucky.
Oh, losing to
Evansville? Yeah. But speaking of embarrassing losses.
Losing to Evansville in non-conference couldn't be us.
Yep.
UW women's basketball.
Should I go to that game on Tuesday? You said it's at 8 p.m.?
I believe it is at 8, yeah.
Are you going?
I will be there.
All right.
Oh, that's you're going to go? You're going to take Baby Fantasy Genius?
Yeah, he was like, you should have taken me to this Mount St. Mary's game. But you kept calling them St. Mary's. And I was like, dog.
If it were St. Mary's, it'd be a much better game.
Well, I'm just like, we're not that many years removed from you knowing the mascots for every team.
It's true.
And you're confusing Mount St. Mary's with St. Mary's. They're obviously different, 7 year old.
St. Mary's got a big win over, I believe, Wisconsin in South Dakota to open the season, which is just like bad
place. They're playing these games in crazier places.
They really are.
I feel like they're just like, go to the coldest place possible. Two random teams play each other there. I mean, that's, and it won't be on TV.
It's kind of Wisconsin territory. UW women's basketball off to a 2-1 start to the season, got an 80-49 win on Friday over Cal State University Bakersfield, and a 94-91 win in a matinee on Wednesday versus Weber State, but in between that suffered a 64-62 loss at home to Tulane. They took a 14-point lead to the fourth quarter in that game, were outscored 27-11 in the final period and gave up the winning layup in the closing seconds. His star Amber Melgoza shot 3 of 14 in that one. But the Huskies, showing some surprising depth so far, had 6 players score double figures in Wednesday's win. Now the UW women taking a 10-day break in their schedule before returning to action on November 23rd. UW football. I don't think we ever actually specifically mentioned this. A 19-7 win on Friday at Oregon State in a game that was much more anticlimactic than the men's basketball game that preceded it. The only score for the Beavers coming on a pick six that got them within one possession. But offense not really doing a whole lot in this one, as they had 119 total yards of offense in the game. An offense that, as we mentioned in the preview, came into this game ranked number 10 in ESPN Football Power Index efficiency this season. Defense back. You seem skeptical.
I think there could be something to playing against your former coordinator.
It didn't work last year. Oregon State was very successful offensively last year.
I have no recollection of that game whatsoever.
Me neither. We attended it, but it is just gone. The defense played so well in this game that they moved all the way up to number 18 in FBI efficiency, which is basically the same as they were the last two seasons.
It's just like they played really well in one game against a team that was ranked very high in efficiency before then. It doesn't make up for the entire season.
I mean, but in terms of predictive power going forward, you hope that it does.
There's just not enough games. You know, if there was a playoff to go to or whatever, playoffs to go to.
64-team playoff?
Yeah, that's I argue every second of every day for a 64-team playoff. I feel like we'd probably be in.
Yeah, so comfortably in the 64-team. I mean, you would want to avoid a misstep against Colorado and Wazoo in the last two games. But, you know, you're on the right side of the bubble at this point.
But it's just like,
God, can you imagine the college football bubble watch?
Be a lot better than arguing about whether Alabama should get in or not.
Your hope is that we can see Alabama and LSU more times. That's you don't see that enough.
I don't know. I mean, they might have just played one very good game.
It did seem like they fixed their two biggest holes, which were number one, not getting any pressure on quarterbacks, and Joe Tryon, after a trying season, had 2 sacks and 4.5 tackles for loss and a dominant performance in this one. Levi Onzurike provided a lot of interior pressure. And then also middle linebacker, we've talked about, has been a serious problem for the Huskies all season long. And redshirt freshman Edufoan Ulufashiu. I had this before. Then I read the pronunciation. It screwed me up. Ulufashiu. Named the Pac-12 Defensive Player of the Week, coming off the bench in this game with 9 tackles and 1.5 sacks for Ulufashiu. So that's a big upgrade there. Mm-hmm.
Clearly the defense is fixed.
I mean, it's just encouraging because you've had seniors in those spots who have not been playing well.
Yes.
And Ulufashiu is someone who can grow into that spot over the next 3 years, and we can grow into correctly pronouncing his name.
I can't wait.
On the other side of the football, not as positive, as the Huskies struggled to throw the ball throughout this game. Jacob Eason going 16 of 32 for 175 yards, was picked twice, including a pick six for Oregon's only score. And the offense, which previously was better than the defense in FBI efficiency by a substantial margin, struggling so badly against what had been an awful Oregon State defense today, dropped all the way down to number 41
They just completely reversed places.
Yeah. It because was a trading places scenario.
Against Oregon State.
But Oregon State like had been playing other Pac-12 teams.
It's so strange.
It is very strange. Ugh. I mean, I wish you could blame it on the weather that like somehow the offenses were bad, but it was just pretty normal Pac-12.
It was just November a weird weather. Game.
Yeah. I mean, for Eason to struggle, maybe in the passing game to struggle, maybe not that weird. Maybe not that weird. Not the first time that's happened. let the record show that Tristan is glaring at me at this point. Encouraging news on offense, the Huskies did get the return of redshirt freshman running back Richard Newton, who had 17 carries.
And the Wildcat is back, baby.
It is. A career-high 54 yards in this game for Newton, who really didn't get eased into it. They just threw him out there and were like, go run a lot. I mean, they ran many plays in this game. Is Savon Ahmed also got 25 carries and went for somewhere north of 160 yards, I believe, in this one, including the 60-yard touchdown that put it away.
But it was kind of just a nice win, and maybe this was the team. The offense didn't play as well as we probably were expecting heading into the year, but maybe this was closer to the team that we were anticipating to have heading into the year, and they finally got it together.
Just in time for the Armed Forces Classic. So the Huskies off this week before traveling to Colorado next week, a game that we still don't know game time on. So look forward to finding that out. The Seahawks, we wrap it up with them coming off that thrilling win on Monday Night Football. If for some reason you didn't listen to the emergency podcast, then is recommended by third Pelton brother Bill Barnwell. It showed it out
on the
Bill
Barnwell show. Recommended it.
Okay. He cited it.
He mentioned it. He also mentioned, he recommended Roger Sherman's Twitter for sure.
That's true.
He mentioned the Pelton cast.
Update on Tyler Lockett, who returned to Seattle on Wednesday on Jody Allen's plane after spending two nights in the Bay Area hospital. Suffered a serious shin bruise, but the kind of worst fears in terms of the swelling did not come to pass, and the Seahawks are still hopeful that he can play after the bye week.
And we'll see. I mean, it's an evolving situation. There's plenty of time.
Right.
So
a long time to go on that one, but very encouraging nonetheless, given Tyler Lockett's importance offensively. The aforementioned game after the bye week on November 24th at Philadelphia will no longer be on Sunday Night Football, as it was flexed out of that spot to a 10 a.m. Pacific start.
Yeah, so we had talked about this, and you predicted this flex.
I mean, really.
Because those are our offline chats, as we just predict flexes for Sunday Night Football games.
I mean, Ben Baldwin had predicted it before me. I just agreed with his analysis, basically, if we're being honest.
You didn't give credit on our offline podcast to Ben Baldwin.
Yeah, I don't feel the need to cite people when we're just talking casually.
But you were mentioning when we were talking about that they would probably move it to a 1 p.m. start.
It's kind of perplexing is there are now only two games at 1 p.m. There's no alternative to the national game on Fox.
Which one moved to Sunday? Packers, Niners moved to Sunday Night Football.
Yes.
And then there's Cowboys, Patriots.
Yeah. I believe.
So like they're basically saying,
I mean, both of those were like national quality games.
Yes. All the garbage. And then you get, Seahawks-Eagles is not garbage.
No.
But it's I'm sure that the Dolphins and the Bills and the Bengals are playing teams. And Brian Hoyer may start. We might see a Driscoll. But
the poop-fexa section of the weekend.
Then it's just back-to-back national TV games.
Yes. And, I mean, that makes sense to the extent that, like, that's a national talent TV caliber game, Cowboys Patriots, as is Packers Niners, and for Packers Niners to just have been a regional game at 1:25 p.m. would not have made sense.
They're huge games.
Yeah. So I think the 10 a.m. thing is wildly overblown myself. I think a lot of why people think it's so bad is because they're not accounting for they're like comparing 10 a.m. starts to all games. And it turns out
all road games.
No, they're comparing them to all games. And it turns out A, home field advantage is a thing that exists. B, you only play a 10 a.m. start when you're flying across the country, and that matters. So whether you play it at 10 a.m. or 1 p.m., at that point is probably not that big of a deal, actually, since the Seahawks practice at like 10 a.m., presumably.
I've got a message for 10 a.m.
What's that?
Bring it on! We are not scared of you, 10 a.m. Pacific.
I mean, the Seahawks should not be. They are 3-0 this season at 10 a.m. Pacific, having beaten Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and Atlanta.
There we go.
It's part of their perfect 5-0 road record this season.
Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and Atlanta.
Three of the top teams of the NFL.
Powerhouses.
Very few teams. I guess one of those teams won. I was going to say that Pittsburgh had a bad loss today. It was to Cleveland.
There we go. I mean, none of them are terrible. It's not like they beat the AFC East.
It's not like they beat Cincinnati by 1 point.
No, they did that at home.
I know. They're not good at home. They're
a significantly worse team at home.
Yeah.
It's kind of strange.
Can we flex some home games to the road?
Maybe a London, Mexico City. Let's just, you know, get a little bit more global.
I mean, especially as the weather turns rainy, let's consider flexing that second Seahawks 49ers game down to Santa Clara again.
It won't matter. We'll have already clinched the number one seed.
Just as long as we can keep George Kittle up in the box, banging on the glass.
Are there any other takeaways from the game, sort of longer term, now that we've had more time to marinate on it, that we didn't discuss on Monday night?
Not really. I feel like we covered a lot of it.
Cool.
I mean, I think...
The defensive line, to me, is one where I don't know how much we really talked about Shaquem Griffin and his snaps.
We did not talk about that, yes. So... Getting snaps over. You said you wanted to save this for this part of the pod because Zach Whitman had tweeted the other day about, can you imagine if Ezekiel Ansah was the Seahawks' lead pass rusher at this point if they had not traded for Clowney?
Do we think that Ziggy Ansah is just injured and therefore ineffective, or?
I mean, clearly when he has been healthy in the past, he has been much more effective. So that seems like the logical.
Has he been that bad this year? Was he take him off the field for somebody who hasn't played in a year and a half bad?
I mean...
And didn't show anything in the snaps that he did play?
It's tough for me to evaluate not going through the all 53 tapes or, you know, rewatching games.
I mean, when...
In terms of production, I think yes.
When Shaquem was in, I'm literally just like watching him on the play because I'm so fascinated what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's like really cheering for him. It's like, I want Shaquem to make a huge play so desperately, pretty much more than anybody else, right?
I'd be happy for anyone to make a huge play defensively. That's just me.
But Shaquem.
I mean, I get what you're saying, but...
I mean, it's awesome to see him, but he's never really, as far as we know... I know at UCF he sort of moved around a little bit, but with the Seahawks, he's never played this position before. So it was kind of a new thing that they were unveiling, and they were doing it against the San Francisco 49ers, the undefeated 49ers.
It was a hell of a time for it. Ansah has one sack in 218 snaps this season.
How many sacks does Clowney have?
I mean, he doesn't... Okay, he's got three quarterback hits.
I'm just saying that's not the exact way to look at it. But
I agree, but it's not like he's been in there like, he's so close to making a play on the quarterback. Like, he's been invisible.
The crazy thing, though, is that, so Shaquem Griffin is playing these snaps in pass rush situations or whatever, and they drafted a defensive end in the first round this year.
But he was not active.
Inactive for the game, which is pretty crazy. To look at. I mean, I probably, Quentin Jefferson, I still sort of believe in Ansah and think that he will become an important player down the stretch, but
Clowney has 14 hurries this season. Ansah has two.
To me, Quentin Jefferson is probably the next best edge pass rusher on the team.
Yeah, that's true. He is number two on the team in pressures with 12 behind Clowney's 27. Ansah has six.
So...
And LJ Collier has none?
Participated in a game. So he has a participation trophy.
He's not even listed in the advanced defense table on Pro Football Reference, which seems troubling. Seems like a bad sign.
So they're obviously trying stuff out and have this full week here now to sort of like get people... I don't know if it's true that the Seahawks have been better after the bye, but anecdotally they have. And they have a week to sort of figure out what they're going to be doing here.
Yeah.
So I'm fascinated to see what it's like.
It'll be an interesting matchup, I think, at Philadelphia.
And then I guess in the interim, while the Seahawks have a bye, sort of just quickly to look around the league, what are we cheering for on Sunday?
I have not looked at this yet, so you're going to have to give me a second. I think that, you know, from a wild card standpoint, the top six teams have sort of separated themselves. So now the Minnesota Green Bay loser of the NFC North is probably the biggest competition for the Seahawks. Green Bay is on bye this week, along with the Seahawks. The Vikings are somewhere in this list of games that I'm not finding them. Oh, here we are. They're hosting the Broncos. So that's a very optimistic to hope for Denver to pull the upset there. I mean, above and beyond that, you know, you'd like to see the
There's
Seahawks.
Not a lot of games this week, it feels like.
There's got to be about the same as other weeks with four bye weeks. The Rams hosting the Bears. Again, I don't know if we dare hope for an upset there in this week's Sunday Night Football game, but, you know, that kind of game would give the Seahawks a little more breathing room for the second wild card spot.
So any week good things can happen. Like, you know, there's a lot of upsets that we hadn't predicted.
And I guess if the Cardinals somehow can pull off an upset against the 49ers, really good news for the Seahawks' chances of winning the NFC West. But again, that's an even longer shot.
Are we cheering for the Patriots, though? Despite all of our best intentions, are we cheering against the Eagles? Because basically any time that you can cheer for AFC against the NFC, you should.
Yeah, probably.
Doesn't sit right.
That's fair. I mean, look, the Eagles are a team that the Seahawks will have a chance to take care of business against themselves. Also, they're not that much in the wild card mix because if they do, you know, it's probably them or the Cowboys for one spot in the NFC East. Like, if one of those teams get hot, that team probably just wins the division. So, it's not a big deal.
All right. I mean, you know, if the Eagles beat the Patriots to get to 6-4, beat the Seahawks, and they're at
7-4. But then they're leading the NFC East if they do that.
But the Cowboys still could be winning games in the same time.
Sure.
I don't know. And it would be nice if the Bears could somehow pull off the upset in L.A., which for some reason that game didn't get flexed. Or was this pre-flexing?
I don't believe this is pre-flexing, but I don't think there was as obvious a candidate as surely Patriots-Eagles would have been protected by CBS. Like, what made the next week a unique situation is that you had this awesome game that was just sitting there is a game that would only have been televised in those two markets and nowhere else.
But in the Packers-Niners game.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it would be nice to sort of eliminate the Rams as a threat. And if the Rams are at 5-5, I mean, they're never gone, but the idea that they're still lingering. We're still scared of the Rams.
For sure.
And
especially with the game to come in LA.
Oh, God.
But good news, it's on the road.
It does seem like most of the teams we're cheering to lose are hosting their games against inferior opponents, though.
They sure are. That is accurate.
It might be a long... So let's all cheer for our fantasy football teams on Sunday.
I think that's a good call.
The Cowboys, which is still a team that I think we should be cheering for, or cheering against, is the only one who are playing on the road at Jeff Driscoll's Lions. But then you have the Vikings at home against the Broncos.
That's how I always refer to them.
The Saints, we're probably cheering against going at Tampa Bay. So that's another one. But then the Panthers are hosting the Falcons.
That mostly matters in the unlikely event that the Seahawks win the NFC West. You're basically just listing NFC teams at some point here.
Who are in the playoff contention. But then the Niners host the Cardinals, the Eagles hosting the Patriots, the Rams hosting the Bears.
Panthers hosting the Falcons. Yeah.
In general, it may not be that great of a day for the Seahawks.
That's fine, because you know what was a great day for the Seahawks? Monday night.
So to quote your boy from Uncut Gems, anything is possible.
I guess that's my boy now. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.